y'all put your hands together for DC Kong.
You guys like dick jokes?
It's actually a ball joke. And dick jokes get a lot of attention, but balls don't get as much attention as dicks do. So I feel like I had to do this for the balls.
He's already banned from 2 open mics, and he's working on getting banned from this one, too. So we're going to let him do his thing, y'all. My home, one of my favorites in the city, as always, is the Eric Hollaback.
Yeah! I'm not sure if that's true. I got to send some emails. It's most likely accurate. Rumors. There's a lot of rumors going around, but I for sure can't go to the Hi-Ho anymore. I'm super banned from that place. Anyway, that's really true. That's been confirmed multiple times. By visits of me going, hello, who can I talk to? And they're like, get the fuck out of my face. I don't want to see you anymore.
Hello?
Is this DC Paul, the millennial Arsenio?
This is DC Paul, the millennial Arsenio in the flesh. How are you?
Good, buddy. Good to talk to you. I had to run back to my car. I'm fat and but when, you know, the millennial Arsenio calls me, I got to run, you know, jump through hoops. Are you gaining weight, DC Paul, like I am? I'm gaining weight. Like, I could probably hold, like, a fucking baby carrot under each tit these days with the...
No, man, I noticed in your comedy special you did look a little bit heavier than I remember you. But no, I'm not gaining no weight, man. I wish I was.
That's kind of, that's a little rude. That was a little rude what you just said there.
Okay, I thought we would have an honest conversation on this podcast.
No, lies. Well, if they're flattering, then you can be honest.
Okay, I've been more physically active lately than I have been in the past. I'm running and doing push-ups and biking. But I have not put on any weight or muscle, I don't think. So there's that.
I'm jealous of how cool you are, DC Paul. Maybe not a baby carrot under each tit. Maybe I could just hold like a pickle. Maybe just a pickle chip. But I'm inflated. Like a pickle chip.
Oh.
Depending on the angle that my girth is against the couch, you know?
Well, I take it as happy weight. Is it happy weight? Depressed weight?
It's quarantine cooking. I really know, you know, learned some things. I'm cooking a little gumbo here and there from New Orleans. I'm cooking.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I'm making roux.
Or even, I've never cooked gumbo by my damn self. That's wild. You making a whole pot of gumbo with everything in it?
Yeah, and then I basically eat it, you know, in front of Murder, She Wrote. So, I'm depressed. I'm depressed, DC Paul. You know, I can't do stand-up except maybe once a week. Are you performing at all over there? What's New Orleans like?
So I'm currently right now in Virginia Beach, but I'll be back in New Orleans in a few days. And no, I'm not really performing as much. I've had some virtual gigs, some digital things with the House of Blues and stuff like that, but much of it is hosting and not stand-up comedy. I've been on stage like maybe twice since the pandemic. Once I got to open up for Richard Douglas Jones, he came in town and did like an outdoor show. And a few days ago, I hosted an improv comedy thing with Mario P and a bunch of those guys.
But I think that when New Orleans comedy, you know, rises again like a phoenix from the ashes, it's going to be on the wings of glory of DC Paul. You know what I mean?
Well, that sounds great. There have been a lot of comedians in the city who have, maintained a comedic presence in ways that I have not throughout the pandemic. I haven't really taken to any digital or, you know, YouTube, anything like that. But, man, there's some guys that have really been working on their craft, and I think that when comedy does rise again, it will be people will be saying names like AJ Bell is doing his thing, and Jorge Velasquez is the only person I know who's actively producing comedy shows, and I think they're open mic, but he's producing, like, weekly comedy shows and I think multiple weekly comedy shows in New Orleans right now.
Yeah, I love Jorge Velasquez. I called him personally. And, you know, they tried to take him down. That's all I'll say about that. But, anyway, what did you think?
Yeah, I remember that. I didn't really follow. Go ahead.
I don't want to talk about that. But, Jorge Velasquez, I'm a big fan of. But he told me some things off the record, and I wasn't that surprised. But let me.
I didn't follow what the accusations were, but I knew that they were trying to take him down, like you said, and that's all I knew.
Well,
AJ
Bell came to the rescue there. I've been dying to ask you. I mean, you know, other than my girth, that was some of your review. You know, I put out a couple specials. I called you multiple times. You know, I'm needy. You know what I mean? I'm a needy person. You know what I mean? What did you think of my fucking stand-up specials? You were in them.
I thought it was hilarious. I am a fan of your comedy, and specifically your style of comedy. The finding the humor in things that would make some people uncomfortable, you know. I thought it was a great concept, you going to all those different spots. I do feel like some of the audiences you were in front of didn't appreciate you, probably. But I mean, I think the authenticity in that is kind of what made the special cool to me. You know, in some rooms, you can hear the people really like giving you love and laughing at you, and in some rooms, not so much, but you still hitting those damn punchlines. And, you know, it was great. It was great. I was happy to be a part of that. Oh, and then the editing, it looked so, whoever did that, it was great. It was a great special, man.
Thanks, man. Yo, I couldn't have done that without you guys. I really, you know, I was watching you every night. I was watching John Rowe every night. I was watching Kyle Smith, mm-hmm. Geneva Thomas every night. That's why I got good. So I really owe it to the community that took me in New Orleans.
Thanks for saying that. And I appreciated what you added to the community, because there was nobody else doing comedy like you. You're so brazen and bold and unapologetic, and a lot of the comedy in New Orleans, people were kind of bent on, you know, not offending anybody, being PC and whatnot, and not that there's anything wrong with that, but you were a breath of fresh air, so to speak, and that you were not concerned about any of those things.
You came to me one day at the Howlin' Wolf, and you know, you offended me one time. I will talk about this. You came up to me and you were like, I hate you. I hate you so much, Eric Hollaback. And I was like, what? Like, I thought we were buddies. I was like shocked. And you go, you make me laugh at things I don't want to laugh at.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But and even me saying I hate you is probably meaning the exact opposite. I could never hate you, but I can't see myself going up to you being like, boy, I hate you. I cannot stand you. You're so funny. Yeah, man, yeah, you did have a great way of making those uncomfortable things. And I don't even know if I said the things that I don't want to laugh at. Maybe there was a point where I wanted to restrict what I laughed at, but funny is funny. You know, I probably have since embraced my dirty sense of humor and my affinity for jokes like that. And now, yeah, I want to hear some more of that shit. Yeah, I'm tired of, I am, it's like I said, you're a breath of fresh air. It can be a little saturated with everybody trying to, you know, virtue signaling through everything they're doing, including stand-up comedy, which is so damn odd to do that through stand-up comedy. But yeah, I'm glad you're doing your thing. I am.
And, you know, I got to, again, just say I love DC Paul so much. He taught me so much about professionalism on and off stage. And you and Geneva have this thing where you can host. Like, Geneva would do her sex toy bingo.
The bingo.
And literally, and I was, like, shocked. For 2 hours and 15 minutes, like, she would give out a dildo. For 2 hours and 15 minutes, she would straight improv comedy, and everything she said was funny. And I was like, what the fuck? I have to prepare. I have to write. I don't have just jokes. I fucking work on them. And she was just like, nothing. And you, the way you would host at the jazz club, you know, the jazz market. Is it called the jazz market on Wednesdays?
Yeah, the New Orleans jazz market is Wednesday night. So, yeah.
You know, how you would so smoothly host and go from jazz to comedy and jazz to comedy. As a host, you did that perfect. When me and Kyle Smith and some people went to try to do comedy, during the jazz crowd, we all bombed, but you kept it along because the crowd there wasn't into, like, you know, material. They wanted to just vibe out in jazz. But your style of hosting that show, like, flowed so perfect with it. So I really learned a lot from you and Geneva and, you know.
Well, thanks. And I also enjoy watching Geneva host that damn bingo. And for the exact same reason you said it, man, for the whole 2 hours, You know, I mean, and I don't know if I can't say a lot of her comedy before that. I didn't think it was all like sex based, but she, when it comes to a sex toy bingo, she got so much sex based material to keep an audience laughing. But yeah, 2.5 hours watching, giving out butt plugs and cock rings and then just entertaining people. Yeah, I love Geneva the damn bingo.
Oh. It's unbelievable the way she would improvise. She would, you know, give a couple of butt plug and then for 10 minutes go into what exactly they were going to do with it. And, like, she didn't, you know, she never repeated herself. It was just unbelievable watching.
Yeah.
I got to ask you this. You know, I did notice that New Orleans, the population would inflate when all the colleges were in town and then deflate in the summer. And that's when the hurricane and the crime would come through. In August every year, there was hurricane season and crime season. That's when I was fucking working one night, I got a gun pulled on me. I don't know if I told you that, but that was in August one time in New Orleans. Since there's not, I mean, a lot of New Orleans has a tourist industry as we benefited from doing comedy during the golden years. Is the crime like hard in New Orleans right now with all the businesses closing?
I mean, yeah, it's been a tough year for New Orleans for a lot of reasons. And yeah, when you have a huge population of people who don't have access to just sometimes life necessities and resources and things like that, coupled with the closing of a lot of our social things, you know, things to keep us occupied while we're poor and bored, coupled with a government that is not properly citizens during the shutdown. Absolutely, crime has been pretty bad in the year 2020 in the world. I also had a gun pulled on me outside my own home just a few months ago.
Damn.
You know, happening in the summertime and whatnot, but I never really knew that to be a down season for crime in New Orleans. You know what I mean? It's kind of part of the architecture of the city.
I felt like it was more like when all the colleges are in town, then the population swells up and the police do, you know, at least protect the college kids. So, you know, I felt like there was more money in the city maybe during the college semesters. Like, I would feel pretty comfortable February through Mardi Gras and pretty comfortable September through Thanksgiving. But during the dog days of the summer, I felt like nobody had cash because all the kids went home and their families aren't coming through the restaurants. And so I felt like things would tighten up financially. And then but that was just maybe I'm wrong. What's going on in the barbershop? You said, you were at the barbershop when I called you, you know, that's kind of like the CIA, the CIA of the black community, you know, people talk, you know, they know everybody's business and they, so what's the word on the street at the barbershop?
Well, this barbershop, again, I'm in Virginia Beach.
Oh,
and,
okay.
And I found a barber on this app called Booksy who turned a little room in the back of his garage into a one-chair barber. It was just me and him in there, and he wasn't very talkative, which I was a little upset about. But, I mean, he was a local, a native New Orleanian, so I got to patronize him, and he was black, so...
All right, but you didn't talk shop at all. What do people think about this? These vaccines coming out? Excited to get it because you'll think it'll open up,
yes.
Or are you worried that?
Well, no,
something's going on.
I'm not uninformed about. I'm highly informed about the vaccine. I am looking forward to getting it. Although I did a this little quiz that kind of tells me where I am in the vaccine line, and I can read it to you, but all I mean, right. I have a long way to go before the vaccine will be available to me, and I have been considering other ways that I could possibly get one early, like one of the vaccine trials. I would totally consider one, and I don't think that as soon as I get the vaccine I'm throwing all of my mask away and I'm going back out to party. I know I still have to wear the mask, and really, vaccines are only, what's the word I'm looking for? Effective if a large part of the population gets vaccinated, you know, to create herd immunity. So if I know it's a lot of skepticism about the vaccine, especially among Black Americans, and it's rightful skepticism, but some of a lot of information is easy to find, and you can be highly informed and decide from there to not get a vaccine versus, like, using skepticism in the history of how Black people have been treated with the medical system in America, which is valid. It is valid, but it's not a valid reason to not be totally informed about what's going on. And, yeah, I'm getting vaccinated the first chance I get, and then if I can skip a line, I will. If I can find a bootleg vaccine on the streets, I find drugs in the world very easily. If I find a bootleg vaccine, I'm getting it. I might get two of them.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. So even with the Tuskegee experiments, the syphilis experiments in Tuskegee, you're like, give it to me, whatever.
I'm not saying, whatever to those things. Those things happen, but I'm absolutely... That doesn't mean I have to be an anti-vaccine. First of all, I got plenty of vaccines already. Let's start there. I got the anthrax vaccine, measles, mumps, rubella. I have a plethora of vaccines, so I don't have any kind of fear of them, even after Tuskegee and everything else that has happened. You know, that happening doesn't mean that you're, for the rest of your life, supposed to be an anti-vaxxer. And, you know, like, that doesn't dictate how everything happens. And even still, if you're concerned about that, there are plenty of ways to educate yourself to figure out exactly what's happening.
You know, I'm skeptical. I've had some former guests tell me it's all a scam. You know, I do half comedians on this podcast and half conspiracy people. So, I smoke weed and I'm prone to paranoia. But, yeah, they were telling me about this RFID chip that they wanted to put in people. You know, I don't want to get chipped. You know, I'm half retarded, but I don't want to get chipped. Can I get personal with you? You know, I met your dad. You know, your dad met my dad even when he came through New Orleans. And
I do remember that.
My
dad was actually on your podcast. You remember? You were recording the podcast. My dad actually didn't he join in on it at the Burr Redux?
Oh yeah, when you were on the first time, back in 2016.
Yeah.
Oh cool. Yeah, yep. Yeah. Oh, I gotta find that clip. Let me play that clip.
Pause for 1 second, because my dad. No, I mean, if you want to keep it going,
yeah,
you want to
keep it going. Yo, come on over here.
Nothing, man. I'm recording a podcast.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we put it on pause.
You come over here for a sec. You know, it's interesting. We've been talking about our dads this podcast.
Yeah, good.
Remember, you met my dad too.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay.
So that's what we've been talking about a little bit. DC Paul's dad just walked in.
Yeah, man.
Hey, actually, can you sit like over here? Just because of the direction of the mic. Yeah.
What's going on, Daddy? I think we probably mentioned you a couple times early in the podcast.
Yeah. So have you been watching DC Paul grow as a comic? Has that been a scary process? Are you ever worried that he's going to put you on blast?
Well, first of all, nothing he would do would surprise me. He's been a performer since he was 3.
Yeah?
Yeah, he's been a performer.
What was his first performance? A school play? Or?
Well, officially, actually, one of his first performances wasn't too far from here. It was at a boys' club that's no longer here. It's in the Bywater. He did a performance there. But he performed around the house and stuff like that since he was like 3 years old. He mimicked stuff he saw on TV. He's been doing that almost all his life, so nothing he would do would surprise me.
What was like a moment where you watched him do a play or something and you're like, damn, like, you know what I mean, this is gonna happen now, this is all he's gonna turn to, just do this full time?
I'm gonna tell a story.
All right.
He came to me and his mother when he was about 11 years old, and he asked could he drop out of 6th grade to pursue a career in performing, in acting at the time. And of course, we told him no, and he cried for about 4 days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah. We didn't understand it.
He would just stare at the moon in the rain.
I wanted to go to New York.
Like, what the hell's going on?
Like 10 or 11 years old.
Man, I wanted to be a child star, and I'm still struggling to get on at 30.
Now, I have my brother-in-law who's married to my sister. He was a theater major in college, and he's done some things in theater. And at that time, when that incident happened, I was talking to him, and he said, you know, some people like to perform, but some people have to perform. And that's how he helped me to understand Darren. He has to perform.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
My daddy just called me Darren.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's all good. That's my name.
Wow. I'm sorry.
How many brothers do you have?
I'm in the middle of three boys.
Oh, okay. That gets confusing.
No, it's all good. No. I mean, people know my name.
Okay.
It ain't no thing.
But you've been coming here. You've been watching him do stand-up, too.
Yeah.
Is that getting better? What's going on?
He's getting better. He's getting better.
He hasn't embarrassed you yet? With
no, him? He doesn't embarrass me. Actually, I've in the beginning, I gave him some tips.
Some stories from audience from the past?
In terms of timing and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was way in the beginning. He has hit his stride now in terms of his stand-up. I will say this, just watching him for over 25 years, he's good at stand-up. He's incredible at open mic poetry and music and acting.
Oh.
I think in terms of his skill set, I think as a musician, he's tops. I think his stand-up is second. I think his poetry is his poetry, original poetry, is like 2A.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you could be a mogul and like conquer different disciplines, you know.
He absolutely could. But his love now, apparently his passion now is stand-up comedy and MCing and what goes along with that.
And acting,
and I support that. But I remember this was shortly after Katrina. He asked me to come see him do his poetry several times, and I didn't go. And then one time I went, we were on Decatur Street, and the audience wouldn't let him off. That was my first time hearing him do poetry. Mm-hmm. The audience wouldn't let him off the stage. And a guy from, at the time, they had HBO had this thing, Deaf Poetry.
Yeah.
Yeah, the guy was definitely was asking about it. I think at some point, obviously, his stand-up comedy will surpass his acting and music, but
I think they all help each other, you know? Like, you know, I do screenwriting and stuff. I think screenwriting helps stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
I think they both
stand-up
go
helps screenwriting. I think, the stage presence from doing poetry, from acting, and all, like, from comedy, all kind of works together. And you know, Daddy, I know I want to do it all.
Yeah.
So just, you know, focusing on...
But also, it's like you got to be tops at one for the others to start those opportunities.
I look at people like Jamie Foxx, right? If Jamie Foxx would have wrote and sold a song to somebody else, and Jamie Foxx was like known as like a great songwriter, mm-hmm. like you would have never known that he's a hilarious comedian or an award-winning actor. You know what I mean? So you kind of have to cast a wide net.
I get it.
And kind of go after as many opportunities as possible. Because like I think what was the big hit for Jamie Foxx? Was it In Living Color? Or was it, you know, because he was doing music before that.
But actually, Jamie Foxx started off doing stand-up. That's when he came into the public consciousness doing stand-up back in the day.
He had a studio album, like, that was for sale before I knew of him as a stand-up comedian.
Jamie Foxx came up in that whole Def Comedy Jam
era
with Steve Harvey and
Martin
and all those guys got Bernie, when all those guys blew up. He came in with that.
Bill Bellamy. I think that like stand-up, you know, it's all honestly a good way to get your foot in the door. But like stand-up, you know, a lot of stand-up comedians, I've never sang on stage, but I want to like start doing some of that. You know, like stand-up, you can be a stand-up comedian and show that you can also act, you can also sing, you know, you can freestyle, whatever. So, yeah, but I want to start doing some of that.
I think your comfort on stage and your stage presence is a plus. I think that you didn't have that to...
Yeah, no.
You didn't have that, you know, because I've known some musicians, really good musicians, locally, who had to overcome
stage fright. Yeah.
And they were great musicians. So I agree with you. I think being able to talk to the audience doing stand-up, because you just, that's, stand-up comedy is immediate reaction kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you have to have an incredible amount of self-confidence to do it.
So then maybe 6 months after that, he passed away, and I went to his funeral at Xavier, and he was a big hero of the city after Katrina. Do you want to speak to that at all?
Sure. So, hold on one second to get somewhere I can figure out this mask. My dad was the chief of police for Xavier University Police Department. Katrina, and really up until he died. But Xavier has a large out-of-state student population. And when the hurricane happened, he had a big part in coordinating with people, parents, and organizations outside of state to either establish contact with the kids, or even if they couldn't get to the kids didn't get home, he was kind of the first point of contact. And really, like the like you said, a hero for people who didn't have something like a father figure in state, especially going to school like Xavier. Yeah, he took his job very seriously. And
is he, so that was about 3.5 or 4 years ago that he passed away. And like I remember we went to that funeral, and then just a few months later it was John Rowe's funeral. Is as this is happening, this pandemic scenario, is your father in your head at all, and what would he think about it?
Absolutely, my dad is in my head. I mean, even before the pandemic, I thought about him every day, and he was a very straight-laced, by the book kind of man. So he would be the one advocating for people staying home, for masks all the time, all the things that annoyed me about Houston right now. He was all about laws and rules. He was just doing each and every one of them in the most annoying way.
Yeah, laws and rules and keeping everyone safe. Being a protector. All right. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I'm walking through Walmart. I'm trying to just gripe for a moment. I don't understand people since gag and walk slowly through a Walmart. Like, people who come to Walmart just to stroll and have a nice time. I hate it.
Yeah.
I think not come to Walmart with a sense of intention. You know, like, walk to what you can to get and get out of everybody's way. The fuck are you strolling in a Walmart for? Get out of my way.
That's where you're at right now? You're on your Bluetooth? People are in your way?
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Also, is John Rowe in your head? Because he's in my head all the time.
Keep it going for DC Paul. It's a weird-ass nigga. It's like, this must be the only time someone's been filmed before they're special with someone roast. How you gonna roast a nigga before he's supposed to be special? I'm supposed to be special, you're gonna make me unspecial. You just like kind of like demeaned me for these people that I don't know that well. Don't believe him, he's a liar. Also, how you gonna bring me up in sweatpants? How you gonna wear gray sweatpants and we can't even see a semblance of your dick? I was looking for it. I was like, you can't even see imprint. You can see a little imprint of my dick, and I got black pants on, you little dick ass bitch. Anyway. Trying to roast me, bitch. Don't you roast. Who you think you roasting? Your porcupine ass bitch. Sometimes I lead into my bitches for no reason.
What?
Yeah.
What does he tell you?
I don't even know. I can't say what he's telling me. I never forget the dude's face, the dude's voice, you know, our dynamic, which was at times tense.
It's only been since Christmas.
Now, for me, you know, John Rowe is a big influence on me just because of the amount of shows he does every week.
Mm-hmm. He's good, too. He's funny.
Has he been like a mentor for you, too?
Oh, my God. Well, the thing is, I won't say that this is how John Rowe has inspired me and has been a mentor to me. So one time around Christmas, I did my Christmas jokes at Carrollton Station, and it went okay.
You have a Christmas sweater.
Yeah, I got plenty of Christmas sweaters. I got a whole section of my closet devoted to Christmas sweaters. But I did my Christmas jokes, and John comes up to me afterwards. He's like, you know what, DC? He didn't even know me, by the way. We weren't friends at the time. He didn't even know me. He's like, you know what, DC? You were good, but you'll never be as good as me because you keep doing all of these plays and you want to do radio commercials and you want to be an actor. You'll never be as good as me until you focus on just stand-up. And at the time, I was like, who the fuck is this dude? Like, he don't know me.
Yeah.
So the way he inspired me is to show him that I can be just as good and better than him on stage and still do everything else that I want to do. You know, like John Rowe likes to take credit for everybody in Young Funny. He wants to say that, like, he had a hand in making somebody better, somebody funnier. John Rowe just inspired me by challenging me, by telling me that I can't do something. Yeah. And, like, that's what I like.
But, you know, I can't imagine what he would be on right now. You know what I mean? Like, if he would be practicing social distancing, if he would be out and about. He probably would be out and about because he lived on the edge a little bit. Yeah, I think about him all the time.
He was just, what I would get from him is just like his not give a fuck attitude about everything. And like he wanted to live as impractical as possible to be authentic on stage.
That kind of sounded weird. Anyway, I'm here to be here. Make some noise for you guys. You guys are beautiful. Oh, this is a beautiful crowd. Life is weird, man. You ever, like, have a slow start to your life? Like, you ever have broke-ass parents? Anybody? Make some noise if you got broke parents. Make some noise if your parents never did shit for you. These Asian kids cannot say anything. I see they're like, our parents have so... It's okay. It's all right. It's no... I wish my parents had as much money as half of your parents. I hate my parents. Like, sometimes it's like no net. Sometimes you need a safety net. I have no safety net, so I have a job where I have to wear a hat. Anybody ever have a job where you have to wear a hat? Yeah. And you got to smile at people, and you know, that shit gets dire, too, because you, like, if I don't smile, they're not going to tip me right. But sometimes you don't want to smile, though. Sometimes you don't smile because your girl just left you and you can't masturbate anymore. Y'all ain't never been in love. Have you ever had, like, a breakup so bad, like, when they leave you, like, they kind of take your sexual organ with them, like, for, like a month or two. Just, like, a month or two. Just, like, a month or two, you can't touch yourself. You ever been like that? Yeah. Have you ever been where you trying to make love to yourself? You're just trying to love yourself as everyone should be able to do, but you can't do it because you see they face in the porn? And it's not because all white girls look the same. No, it's because love is strong.
So he lived like a cartoon kind of life in a weird way.
Yeah, I remember one time, and this is, I think, before we had the language to describe what he was talking about. But I remember one time him telling me that he didn't want to be considered a man or a woman. He just wanted to be considered a spirit. It was, you know, I think he was touching on something without knowing where he was going with it. But he was definitely, you know, like, I'm not... You know, I don't want to be a he or she. I just want to be, call me John, but you don't have to regard me as any gender.
Yeah, and he was also sexually experimenting all the time with men trying to be women trying to be men, lesbian girls. And then he would talk about, he wouldn't tell, like, if I did something like that, I would tell DC Paul before I brought it on stage. So, you know what I'm saying? But John was the opposite. He would have weird sex, and the first time everyone heard about it was on stage.
Was on stage, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, and then I started to realize... This guy's doing it for...
Just to have material.
To push the boundaries of himself. To go, man, if you... I remember him saying, I'd say, you ever had a sex with a man trying to be a woman? Or a woman trying to be a man? You don't know about love. Don't tell me about love. I was just like, he was the craziest person, but he had zero secrets.
Inhibitions. Yeah. Yeah, he definitely did.
So that's what he kind of taught me. You know, I had some, you know, problems with some other comics sometimes, and the way he was, like the friendship I had with him, sort of gave me confidence to stick to my guns. You know.
That's cool.
All right. you playing any? You do you want to say anything else about John before I ask you one last question and get you out of here?
No, I don't have anything else to reflect on my man John Rowe at the moment.
Are you playing? How are you? How are you keeping yourself entertained without stand up, without comedy, without shows? Are you playing some board games? You playing any Operation? You playing some Monopoly? You know.
Not really. I'm not really a game person like that. I recently did play the new Cheetah's edition of Monopoly. It was a lot of fun.
Cheetah or Cheater?
Cheater. Cheater's edition.
Oh, so you...
It's some extra rules. Yeah, some extra rules kind of to cheat the game a little bit. Makes it more fun.
So it's more realistic way to train to be a banker.
Right. Yeah, actually, in that version of it, you pass around the bank to each player. Whoever's rolling the dice has the money tray. And you can't just steal just for the sake of stealing. But some of the steal cards say, you know, if you steal from the bank, you get this reward. If you get caught, you get this penalty. It's pretty cool.
So if another player sees you dose yourself a $500, then you're caught, and then you get, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, but then if the next person rolls the dice without you getting, without them noticing that you did that, then, like for that particular card, if you steal from the bank, everybody has to give you $100 if you get away with it.
Oh, okay. That's dope.
Yeah, two different things. Like if you move somebody else's game piece, that's called stealing that identity. That one has a reward on it. Pretty cool.
That's dope. Yeah, I mean, it's back to basics. Now it's like, oh, you know, it used to be like I go to the strip club, you know, go crazy, you know, go out to bars, talk to girls. Now it's more like, oh, you got Operation and Jello shots, you know what I mean? You know, that sounds fire, you know? So my priorities have changed.
I feel bad.
That's all I want to say. Thanks for being on the podcast, DC Paul. How can
people... Oh, thanks for having me, man. You go ahead.
How can people find you?
Oh, I'm easy to find in person and especially online at whoisdcpaul.com or whoisdcpaul on any social media network.
Whoisdcpaul, whoisdcpaul.com. I also want people, if they haven't seen it, to go to my YouTube, Eric Hollerback, you know, or erichollerbach.com and watch my specials that feature DC Paul. Are you in the first one? Are you in Conspiracies and Dick Jokes? Yes, you are. You're in Conspiracies and Dick Jokes, right?
Yes, I am.
All right. Mm-hmm. And then there's also Fart Porn and Beer Halls, which features Geneva Joy and Thomas Jones. Mm-hmm. And then there's It's a Medical Device, which features Kyle Smith.
Excuse me. Yeah, okay. I know you was putting it work like that. That's three whole shows.
No, I'm excited. So it's out there. Thanks to one of my best friends in the world, one of my biggest inspirations, my comedy peer, the millennial Arsenio, DC Paul. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, Eric.
Good to talk to you. Talk to you soon, brother.
Yeah.